All right, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon, everyone. The Commission on Equitable Housing and Development meeting is now commenced. It's August 3rd at 4 p.m. This meeting is being held virtually due to COVID-19 to allow for social distancing and protect the public health. As we continue our efforts in meeting remotely, we ask all commissioners and guests to mute yourselves until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. For those who have dialed in using the call-in number, to unmute to speak, dial *6 on your phone. Also, prior to speaking, please announce who you are to identify yourself. As a reminder, this meeting is being recorded. We ask that you only use the chat function to request to speak or to announce you're leaving the meeting so we can track quorum. Also, to comply with the state open meeting law, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio, not by using the chat function. So we're going to do roll call. Maggie Amato-Tayez.
Here.
Wendy Asher.
Here.
Mary Ann Beerling's absent. Mindy Bernstein, I see her in the waiting room. Hey, Mindy. Mark Clark.
Yo.
Vicky Casino is absent. Sharia Jimenez is also absent.
I'm here.
Oh, hey. How you doing? Lori Mazurbo?
Here.
Hey, Lori. Tisha Tallman?
Here.
Jim Topol, I am here. Ray Winch?
Here.
Kenny Wong? Kenny is absent. And Jay Young?
Here.
Okay, our ex officio members, Ann Shenanka? Hey, Ann?
Yep, here.
Corin Manning? Is Corin with us? Betty Viegas. And Marcos Ismail.
Here.
Okay. First agenda, or actually second agenda item, is to review and adopt the July 6th meeting minutes. They were sent out last week. Are there any changes to the meeting minutes?
In light of the response, I'm happy to move their adoption as distributed.
Without objection, we'll okay. Just approve them, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay. Anybody object to just saying they're approved? All right. Agenda item number 3 is the call to audience. This is a time when any member of the public may address the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. Due to time constraints, the total time allocated for this is 15 minutes. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes each. Due to open meeting law, commission members cannot discuss topics that are not on the agenda. Items brought up by the public may be considered as an agenda item for future meetings. So, Victoria Alice Van Helsing. You go ahead when you're on.
All right. Can you hear me?
We can.
All right. Okay. I'm going to build a tiny home. So I want you to know that you can do that for under $3,000. I'm going to build it on a trailer. And I hope that I can participate with the city, show you how to do that, and we can get tiny home communities up and running. I also have solutions for people to build tiny, tiny little tiny homes that are bike trailers for $150. And we can do that on a plot land have bathrooms, check-in, everything like that. I have several models and makeups that I've written out. So I'm going to, you know, obviously I've sent some of them to you, but I can send them again and I can make more and send them to everybody. But I have solutions. And so I'm pushing for that. I'm pushing for policy for tenant protections. I have several policies that I'm pushing for, and I'll be doing public speaking. So that means I will show up at mayor and council. I will show up at the county, and then I'll show up at the state level. And I'm just going to go through the entire thing. I'm not going to stop. Okay. Because best practices, best science, break it down, you know, get her done. It's very simple. We need a drop-in center with lockers, and we need something other than SROs, because people might want to have a relationship, might want to move forward with their life. So there are other things like that that we need to consider when we actually do get property. So yeah, look at your property, go out and own what the city actually owns, talk and call people, make a checklist, call these people, find the best contractors, make an effort to like make a goal, and then just go from small goals and break it down. I'm here for case management. I'm making about 11 documents on best practices for case management. I'm my own case manager right now, so I'm offering my services for free. I work as a case manager. I may not work with the city, but that's what I do. So I'm here ready to be hired when you're ready. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you, Victoria. Is there anybody else who'd like to speak? let the meeting minutes show that Kenny Wong is now with us as well. Okay. We'll move on to agenda item number 4, which is the homeless and encampment update. So Jason Thorpe and Brandy Champion, you have the floor.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to go ahead and present first because I just have a brief overview. I think Jason has a lot more content than I do today. So I'm just going to give you a brief overview of Housing First and homeless protocol. And I'm going to go off camera for that. Can everybody see that okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so the 5 pillars of Housing First are immediate access to housing with no preconditions. People benefit when they're able to make their permanent changes with a roof over their head instead of living outdoors. Participant choice and self-determination. People do have the right to make their own decisions with some guidance, and self-determination goes a long way in a recovery orientation. So recovery orientation is also part of Housing First, but we've got to deal with trauma and other things, behavioral health issues, substance use issues before we can get to a stabilized place. So case management in your housing is really critical. Individualized and participant-driven supports are very important. Them being a part of their own case plan needs to happen when people are in a Housing First program. And of course, social and community integration, getting reconnected to the community, to their neighborhood, to their neighbors, to their landlord, to their families. That's important when we're dealing with housing people that have experienced homelessness. So Housing First is not a traditional pathway. In past programs, people have had to get sober, gain employment, do a certain amount of program participation before they're eligible for housing. Housing First allows us to put people right into housing, which I feel is a basic human right, and then work with them on all of the things to get them stabilized and moving forward in their life. So some of the new programs in the Housing First Division are pretty neat, and they work around the Housing First model. We have community safety navigation and street outreach and coordinated entry navigators that are supervised. There's six of those direct service staff and one supervisor in that area. Our shelter sites include Wildcat and Amazon that we actually oversee and operate, and that has one supervisor and 9 direct service staff. Desert Cove is also another shelter that's owned by the city of Tucson, but it's operated by our partner CBI. Mobile shower program is operated by 2 staff, and that is in full force. In July, we began that program back up, and we have served 84 in the month of July so far. And that's also managed by the supervisor that oversees our shelter operations. HART Navigation, which stands for Housing Emergency Action Response Team, and Crowd to Home work with people that are already in their housing, usually in a voucher. Our goal there is to keep them in their voucher, providing them direct service in their home for wraparound services like behavioral health, substance use, working with DCS, probation, whatever needs to occur to stabilize them in their housing. That's one supervisor and 6 direct service staff that provide that case management service. Homeless protocol consists of 1 supervisor, 1 outreach staff, and 1 admin support staff. In October of last year, the Regional Homeless Task Force came into play, and a multi-agency resource coordinator, Mari Vasquez, previously with TC3, was recruited to be the city-county coordinator. And she is at the city manager's office on the 10th floor, and she helps us coordinate that whole group. We meet with that group once a week, either virtually or in person, and it consists of many different departments, which I'll get into next. MDOT, which is the Multidisciplinary Outreach Team, has already hired its outreach person. That's with the city of Tucson, and we are meeting next week to begin the process of getting other players on board, a nurse practitioner from El Rio, and outreach and navigation staff from CBI and OPCS. Homeless protocol, the people that participate in our weekly department task force meetings around homeless protocol are all of these different players: our city attorney's office, business navigators, the mayor's office, environmental services, housing and community development, community safety, health and wellness, Pima County, parks, fire, DTM, which is the Department of Transportation and Mobility, SunTran, CORE, which is the team that works out of TPD that helps with homeless protocol, Tucson Police. So we have a lot of different departments coming to that meeting weekly and coordinating and collaborating around the homeless encampments throughout Tucson. Some of the changes that we've made in the encampment protocol process are getting a real flow to it. The homeless encampment protocol has been around since 1978, and it was kind of just a way to get rid of basically homeless encampments. It started at the base of A Mountain years ago, 1978, as I said, and over the years, that's been kind of what it's been about, is kind of a game of whack-a-mole. You call homeless protocol, they get somebody out there to remove the encampment, and they move somewhere else, and 2 days later, they're back in that same encampment. Even though we're seeing that today, things are changing as far as getting people into shelter and having them accept services with our different shelter providers and housing providers around Tucson. So this is the flow of the work. A report submitted, it goes to our encampment coordinator, she verifies the location of the report, an email is provided to the person that reported it. All along, she's sending it to another team. Outreach is initiated on that encampment to provide a tier assessment on the encampment and a harm assessment. A case is opened depending on the evaluation score of that harm assessment, and a tier is assigned, either a tier 1, 2, or 3. And I'll get into what those tiers mean in just a moment. If an email was provided by the reporter, that reporter will be updated as to the status of the encampment. Either the case is monitored or closed, depending on what the outcome of the case is. And how we determine the encampment assessment, is by tier. A tier would be like just a breeze. Maybe an encampment was there and they've moved on. And there's just debris left from that encampment. And so that's a cleanup and the report is closed. A tier 2 is an encampment that is not a criminal element in the community or not in close proximity to somebody's home or business. So outreach is provided to that camp. Cleanup and monitoring is provided until we can get those people indoors and into a home. A tier three encampment is more along the lines of if there's a criminal element, if there's a nuisance to a homeowner or a business, then we provide intensive outreach there, offer services away from that site, and then we post a notice and enforcement and the encampment removal and cleanup is then initiated. If you are interested in reporting an encampment, here is a QR code. And I believe Neto did send out these slides so that people have access to them so that you can report an encampment and we can get outreach out there. And that is a conclusion of my stuff. So does anybody have any questions for me? Or I see that I saw Mindy had her hand up. Mindy, did you have a question for me?
I didn't. It was more of a statement. I suspect that you've seen my name on a number of encampment reportings. And I feel awful when I do that. I live across the street from a city park that becomes unusable for families, children, quite frightening for us. So I was surprised when I first called in, but thanks, Brandy, for doing it. I think that this process works much better than having TPD come out and move people.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I own it. I'm not in my back, not in my front yard. And I hope to help in other ways. Thanks.
Thank you, Mindy. Wendy, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I just had a question. I really appreciate you giving an update on the housing first approach and being clear on that. And I wondered, you know, we've seen a lot more recently homeless folks, people who've been unsheltered because of the pandemic and losing jobs, et cetera. And I wonder if you've had any different outcomes and how effective the housing first approach has been with people who are longer term unhoused as opposed to shorter term unhoused. And if there's different approaches or programs that are targeted to those different populations.
I would say yes. I would say that for the increase in the unsheltered population, when the moratorium lifted, we saw a lot of elderly and families, of course, become homeless. And that's a majority of what we're serving in our shelters at this time. So we're seeing a lot of elderly and families with small children. I think that there is a difference in because of the way that we're doing shelter, and we want the end result to be housing instead of just a quick turnaround and back to the street. Although, you know, it takes a little longer for some people than it does others because we have to do document collection and application, filling out of applications and vouchering. I think we've seen a difference in that area. We're in the process of measuring those things currently. We just finished up our fiscal year, of course, in June. So we'll have some better idea of what that looks like moving forward. I see a couple of people. Did that kind of answer your question or?
Yeah, it did. Because we see different responses from folks based on the length of time that they've been unsheltered and sort of the trauma and drama of more recent issues with housing. So yeah, it does kind of answer my question. It was what I was assuming. So yeah. Thank you for validating what I was observing on another context.
Okay. Jim, I see you have your hand up. Did you have a question?
Right. I've got a couple of questions. First of all, thank you for this presentation. Are you guys working at all with the HSL's Holodome facility and the that hotel space? Is that part of anything you guys are coordinating with? Or
Anne, can you So, are you all working with HSL at all? I know that we're...
Brandy, I think he's asking about Gospel Rescue and the Center of Opportunity.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. Actually, HSL does coordinate with us quite a bit. When we're going into an encampment and we know that we have to remove it, Gospel Rescue is totally willing to give us available beds, Salvation Army as well, Primavera Men's. So we do have all the nonprofits and the other partners are in the area are working with us on those things. So,
okay. And what about the Tucson Crime Free Coalition? Are you working with them as well? Because I know that they're pretty active right now in this space and in terms of trying to address some of the issues.
I wouldn't say that we're working with them, but we do, you know, listen, we hear them, we hear everybody that has something to say about everything that's going on. And so we do try to address the issues that they may have.
Okay. Yeah. There's a couple of people in that group that are constantly like chirping in the back of my ear. So obviously this is a huge issue, not just for Tucson, but everywhere right now. And it's getting worse. I guess the $50,000 question is, what do you guys think we need to do going forward? Is there something that we can help champion for you guys to, you know, with the rest of the city to help address what's happening right now?
I think we need more housing. Our affordable housing is, we just don't have enough. We don't have enough inventory. Shelter is always scarce. Our shelters are always full, as well as Primavera, Gospel Rescue, when people want to go there. The reason why people shy away from Gospel Rescue is because they're separated or they can't take their bed or their pet or their partner, what have you. They can't stay in the same area, right? So, you know, more low barrier shelter, more housing is what I'm seeing that we do not have.
So I'm going to follow that up with two more questions. So the Affordable Housing Subcommittee had a presentation this last month, and it had some statistics on the bed usage of all of our shelters. Maybe I'm getting confused with the previous CHD meeting, but if memory serves, I thought it was like 65 to 70% bed usage on average across all the facilities. So given that, what type of housing do we need? Is it temporary shelters or what type of housing?
It's both. It's affordable housing and shelter beds. Jason, do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. So, that data point, Jim, that comes from the annual housing inventory count that you're referencing, it can be a misleading number because it accounts, without getting too deep into kind of the data methodology there, I've had, it accounts for the number of beds that are sort of estimated at the time of an application to HUD in a supportive housing program. And so maybe a program assumes it's going to have families of four with three bedrooms, and then instead it actually gets referred primarily single adults, then it's going to report as underutilized. The same way with sort of family-based shelter, that kind of non-congregate shelter that's unit-based. So those numbers are a bit distorted. We do know that we know that our shelter bed utilization is not at 100% most nights, but it is much closer. You know, it is higher than the number that's reported in the annual housing inventory count. We also believe it's probably lower than what is reported in the daily shelter bed reporting that you see. So, there's certainly a bed utilization issue. The other part of our presentation today, and I don't know, kind of based on time, I know we had 30 minutes here and there are still several questions for Brandy. So Jim, sort of your decision there, if you want us to hold the other part of the presentation for tomorrow or for next time. But in that piece, what we'll take a look at is some system modeling that we've done through the continuum of care that really starts to articulate the number of beds we need of each housing type and what an estimated annual cost to really end homelessness would look like in our community.
My inclination, just in terms of timing, is that, you know, this is something we've been wanting to talk about for some time, and I don't want to cut it short. So let's move on. Thank you for answering my questions, Brandy and Jason. Kenny?
Hi, thanks for the presentation, Brandy. I'm wondering if part of the reporting, you know, is there information on both how many like reports in each of the tiers are being submitted to the city? You know, that's one thing. Effectiveness after the reorganization of, you know, is there in outcomes that we're seeing? And then building off of that, you know, what are the outcomes? Have folks been able to get connected, whether temporarily or in the long term, from the revised protocol?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are those numbers, Kenny. And actually, we're in the process of working on a public-facing dashboard where you'll be able to see those numbers soon. As a matter of fact, that's what I was doing this afternoon, is working with our homeless protocol team and our IT. We're trying to tighten that up so that eventually you guys will be able to see it. We present those to mayor and council often. And there is a reporting system in the background that's showing us the effectiveness of our work. And we see it. We see it on the Housing First side, because we're the ones going with our outreach teams into these encampments, finding people that are matched to housing that their agency hasn't been able to find, match them with their agency and get them moving along, as well as putting them in shelter when those beds are available, and working with them to get them housed, and working with folks from encampments to get them housed, get their documents collected, and leave them in place in an encampment when it's not a problem, and be able to go back to a place to give them updates and get them eventually into their housing. So we do see a difference with this whole new tier system.
Ray?
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's a few questions. One question I have is, how many people end up actually just getting pushed to another location? Like if people maybe don't want to go to Salvation Army or Gospel Rescue Mission, and if are there other viable options that we're able to offer? And if not, yeah, how many people just end up getting moved but are not going into housing?
I don't have a number for that, Ray, but I'll tell you the issue is larger than the resources. So I will say that we know this, right? We've worked together before on a couple of encampments, you and I. So the issue is larger than the resources that we have. So that's why we're hoping, you know, with our recent spotlight on Tucson, we want to escalate this, right? We want resources to be poured into Tucson so that we can have a bigger service, because we have a bigger need, right? So I would imagine that the number is not pleasing, to say the least, but we are definitely working toward a resolution. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That was my impression of it, is that it seems like a lot of the dashboard is focused on accommodating neighbors and business owners, but without the actual amount of housing units. It's like, what's the option there? And I wonder about, one, how much this costs, two, what the costs are of the staff time, of how much staff time and resources is going into actually just moving people from place to place, and how much of that could go into just the housing so that people are actually able to only be moving people when there's actually a place for them to go. It seems like there's so much pressure being put on the city to move people when there aren't the resources of where they're going. And I know HCD is doing so much, like maybe more than any other time, of increasing our amount of affordable housing in Tucson, and it's still not enough to meet the need. And like where you would want the resources to go, like, do you want to be doing this homeless protocol? Is there another place that you'd want to see those resources being used more effectively to actually get people into housing?
Okay, Shay.
Yeah, I guess I just have similar questions about, you know, that other people are asking, like moving forward, if there was any, you know, policies or other outcomes that are coming out of all this data, you know, that I mean, aside from just, which to me, it's always comes down to money, more money.
That's the truth. And looking at other communities, Shay, we're actually going to be visiting Austin, Texas. They have a community called Community First, and it's actually tiny homes. So there's things that we're looking at and investigating. And, you know, Jason's done a lot of research around tiny homes, and it's being discussed. So I will say that we're looking at it from all points of view. So,
And thank you. That reminded me of the other part. You know, I think even when Victoria was speaking earlier, I was thinking about, you know, ways that we have to reimagine shelter and what shelter looks like and how some of the standards, you know, I feel like I've been trained as a traditional houser, you know, where we have these really high, you know, technical and quality standards for housing that make it really difficult for anyone else to participate who's not a professional developer or professional builder. So I'm just curious if some policies that will help, you know, more of the DIY kind of group be able to participate in a way that's still safe and still meets hopefully some form of code minimums. You know, yeah. That's also where my mind has been.
Okay, thanks, Shay. Tisha? We can't hear you, Tisha. Still can't hear you. Mindy, why don't you go and then she can get her audio fixed.
I've been doing some reading, a bit of research, and I know that some of my ideas are off the rail or different. One of the articles that I recently was reading, and I don't remember what city and I can find it, is that the city had a trust, a fund, where they were bidding against equity, for profit entities that were trying to purchase single family homes. And the city bought them and then sold them to actual residents, people who were living in the community for affordable rates. So we've not talked about that possibility for the city of Tucson to pass some zoning laws or to put money into purchasing our own housing for our own citizens, which I like the idea of. I know that West University is going to be gaining a swath of property. I'm having somebody ask about that at the WUNA meeting this afternoon. And it will be an area that is surrounded by a lot of freeway underways. Would it be an ideal location for a tiny home village? So that was one of the things that Victoria brought up, was tiny home villages, having been highly successful in many other cities. So how I know Steve Kosacek is producing plastic CMU blocks. There's so much happening. And I guess my frustration is that we're not getting things. They're moving slowly, and I'm so much wanting to see momentum. So that's all. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mindy. Tisha, is your audio working?
We can't hear you.
No. Maybe select a different microphone. Sometimes using your computer, your laptop or something. Jay, why don't you go ahead and go?
Just a process question for today. Is Jason going to be able to present today? Are we going to continue with this? Okay, I'll hold until after Jason's done.
All right, Wendy?
Thanks. You know, so I get how it's hard to not sort of think in terms of urgency and people being out on the street and all the things that are wrong with that. But what resources are we looking at to prevent people from falling into these circumstances? I know from my work, I know that one of the issues that's come up consistently is that, you know, landlords are just, I don't know how to say this any more politely, are just really greedy. And we see how much rents have gone up in the last couple of years to just price people out, properties being bought up by out-of-state developers so that the properties can either be raised or remodeled so that they're fancier and nicer, you know, kind of nasty quality of gentrification. And basically that makes people much more vulnerable to losing what was previously affordable housing. So, and it's much more expensive to fix a problem than to maybe try to prevent it. You know, when people are already losing resources and losing work and their kids are out in the street and trying to do, you know, trying to keep some stability in their lives, what are we looking at in terms of not housing first, but like just housing, I guess, the way to look at it?
I think it boils down to affordable housing, Wendy. I think that's what it boils down to, bottom line, and building affordable housing for people that they can rent without, with just, you know, regular income.
I think it also comes down to the entire housing spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a lack of land that is available for new projects. There's people who want to build here, but can't find a site that's properly zoned. So there's, you know, I think if they can do things to help all levels of housing, I mean, a lot of supplies and demand will kick in at some point. All right, Tisha, do you want to go now?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you, Michael. Couple things. Couple comments and then a couple questions. One is in regards to Tier 2. I was wondering what sorts of resources, if any, the city's providing to identify Tier 2 encampments and whether or not there are, in fact, Tier 2 encampments currently active. And then the other, I did want to speak a bit about bed utilization, because that's definitely, you know, while we know we feel like we're at capacity, the TPCH, that one day pit count did note that bed utilization was down everywhere. I know that Jay Young, the report that we just had distributed to us, which is amazing, by the way, and I know it utilized some of the data from the individuals that we serve, that you did focus in on bed utilization as well. And I think we should dive into that a little bit more, and their thoughts on shelter, congregate, non-congregate. But I think based on what we're seeing, we are rethinking the shelter model and what we need to have that shelter look like. I know there's a huge need in that, so any bed is a bed that we want to continue to have. But I do think moving forward that there's other things happening in community that signals we need to rethink shelter, congregate or non-congregate, and what it all offers and who we're serving and how we're serving individuals. I think encampment democratization is one factor. I think pets are a factor. I think when you have a congregate setting, loved ones not being able to be with you is a factor. So these are just kind of things that we're thinking about and talking about, because we know that moving forward, things need to change. COVID may have been a dress rehearsal for more pandemics and endemics moving forward. What that does is move people out of our shelters. You know, we still have COVID coming up in our shelters, and we have to move folks out for a while and then move people back in. So I think that the bed utilization rate is something that's on our radar and something that I would love for us to continue to have that conversation and really take a look at that and see if it's at least signaling to us that there's something that needs to change in regard to temporary shelter. I also, to that end, you know, I agree, of course, we need more affordable homes for rent and for homeownership. we're not unique to any other place in this country, but, you know, in looking at the data, it is pretty stark for us in being able to ensure that people have that affordable housing, because what's happened over the last few years, some of it is, you know, merely there's no stock, but some of it is market forces and what's happening within Tucson. I think some of it is also policy related at the state level, and I haven't heard anyone talk about that much, but Arizona is a pretty punitive state when it comes to municipalities having those tools that they need to ensure that there's affordable housing. So, you know, something on the state level. But I also think that there's, you know, while we need to make sure we increase affordable housing stock, we also need to preserve the affordable housing stock we currently have and examine, you know, where it is in regards to opportunity structures and vulnerability index. And then one thing that we're noticing that we're really trying to work towards addressing is the fact that we have temporary shelter because of some things that happened with HUD and funding. There's very few transitional housing opportunities. And then you have rapid rehousing. So, you know, we have this long delay. There's a huge need in the transitional housing component so that we don't lose people back into the streets or encampments. So, for example, just this last fiscal year in our men's shelter, there was an 80% exit into unsafe environment, and 60% came back more than once, one or more times during the last fiscal year. So there's definitely something going on in regards to how we temporarily shelter folks and those long delays before rapid rehousing that ends up not people we're losing folks. It's kind of some food for thought. And I think, you know, the report that was sent around by CIRO, today, thank you so much. I think that work on that qualitative approach to talking to folks in shelter and what's going on with them is going to be something that needs to be looked over time, you know, longitudinal study of what's going on with folks for us to really get a handle on multiple ways of addressing the issue. And so tier two, my question on tier two. Thank you, Brandy.
So the tier twos, yes, there are tier twos. I don't have that number. Elle and Madi handle that reporting, so I can get that for you. There are tier twos, and what the criteria for a tier two is that, number one, they're cooperative about keeping their area clean. Number two, they're not causing an issue with a business, like stealing the business's metal or wood or whatever the business, the generators, what have you. And they're not causing an issue with people being in a person's backyard. I mean, if your kids are playing in the backyard and there's an encampment 10 feet away from you and people are doing numerous things in that encampment, you know, you don't want that there, right? So those are the criteria for assessing a tier two encampment. I mean, if they're in the middle of the desert and we, you know, they're going to get water each day and they're not in direct vicinity to somebody's home or business, and they're keeping their camp clean, then we're going to try to work with them from that encampment to get them into a shelter situation. It takes a lot of engagement, meaningful engagement, with the right outreach worker to convince somebody to come indoors. A lot of times when people have been homeless for a number of months or years, they're not totally willing to just give up the little bit of stability that they have to come and follow you into what they don't know. So, and especially with low barrier shelters becoming a new thing, people are used to, you know, the higher barrier shelter rules and separation and no pet and this and that and having to board their animal or what have you, and they're just hesitant. So it takes, I mean, we outreached the Golf Links encampment the first time that we removed that for 6 weeks before people would like willingly say, okay, we're going, we're giving up this much stuff and we're coming with you. So it's a lot of work. And so we're willing to do that. And we're looking for other resources. And I can get you those numbers, Tisha. I'll get that from Elle.
Thank you, Brandy. And I did want to say too that your presentation was very good. I appreciate the visualization.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no other questions, let's go ahead and move on to the second half of the presentation with Jason.
Okay. Let me share my screen. All right. So the way my screen is set up, I will not be able to see you while I'm presenting. So can someone just confirm you can see the slide deck that says current homelessness trends and data collections in Tucson?
Yep.
Thank you so much. And then also, Neto, would you be willing to give Dr. Bentley permission to speak as well? I see that he's in the attendee group.
Will do.
And I have the somewhat awkward task of presenting a bit of his work this afternoon. So, Keith, please feel free to jump in when we're talking about the homeless needs assessment. If there's anything you'd like to share, by all means. So thanks for having us this afternoon. So whereas Brandy was able to talk about what the city is doing specifically, my goal is to tell you a little about three data collections in particular and sort of what, and really kind of an amuse-bouche approach to that. So some really high-level information about the findings of these three data collections, and then give the commission an opportunity to have a discussion about how you want to engage in sort of accelerating our shared work to end homelessness. So of course we work very closely with the Tucson Pima collaboration to end homelessness. And so each of these collections has been done in partnership between the city and the Tucson Pima collaboration to end homelessness, as well as our partners at Pima County and CIRO. So we'll talk about the 2023 point in time count, the homelessness needs assessment that was recently completed by Dr. Bentley, as well as homeless system modeling, which is an exercise where we use data about the number of people we know to be experiencing homelessness, assumptions and projections about the number of people we don't know, the costs of services and the length of those services to estimate the cost of truly ending homelessness in our community. And so I'll give you some of those preliminary numbers at the very end. So first, some key findings from the 2023 point in time count. The first is that just over 2,200 people were experiencing homelessness on a single night. And so the point in time count, of course, has lots of limitations. There are populations that are always undercounted. For example, unaccompanied youth, families with children, populations that really have something to risk by being found tend not to be seen. The same with survivors of domestic violence, folks who are actively fleeing domestic abuse, human trafficking experiences, sexual exploitation, et cetera. So we know that the true number of people experiencing homelessness on any given night is more than this, but that's the number that was counted this year. And of those 2,200 people, just over 1,500, 1,501 were unsheltered. So we know that you're twice as likely, if you're experiencing homelessness in Tucson, you're twice as likely to be unsheltered as you are to be sheltered. And in the next slide, you'll see how that's a trend that's really changed over the last 5 years. And so really a quite alarming trend, honestly. We also see, as we can look in backward, a 300% increase in unsheltered homelessness since 2018. As we mentioned, there was, you know, every year the point in time count and housing inventory count that is conducted with it will show that our shelter bed utilization is quite low. And again, this year it was much lower than we'd like to see it be. With that said, it was increased by 22% since the prior year. And so that's a really meaningful increase and something that we're very proud of and know that our shelter partners worked really actively to achieve. And then also a very concerning trend, we've seen a 200% increase in chronic homelessness since 2018 and a total of 789 people experiencing chronic homelessness on the night of the 2023 point in time count. And so as a reminder to folks, chronic homelessness is someone who's experienced homelessness consecutively for a period of 12 months or more, or has experienced homelessness four or more times over the last 3 years, and that those times together form a period of at least 12 months, and then also have a disability. So very shorthanded, someone who's experienced homelessness for a very long time, and who also is particularly vulnerable because of a disability. So we know, of course, unsheltered homelessness is worsening dramatically. You really, of course, you know, you didn't need me to present a slide to share that with you, but I do want to give you some of those specific data points to see what the data is telling us and how that's matching what we're seeing in our community. So this chart will show you that kind of trend that I mentioned of going from 2018 to 2023, the overall number of people experiencing homelessness, as well as that ratio of people who were sheltered in that population versus people who were unsheltered. And so when you look at 2018, 2019, 2020, in those years, we see significantly more sheltered people than unsheltered people. So, and homelessness was much smaller than it was in 2022 or 2023. We excluded 2021 from this graph because we did not conduct an unsheltered point in time count in 2021 due to the pandemic. So what you see is, as we're coming out of the pandemic in 2022, we see that first spike where unsheltered homelessness really increases. We're at about 1,649 people who are unsheltered, 578 who are sheltered. It's worth noting that in 2022, we conducted the point in time count using data estimations. We partnered with Dr. Bentley over at the University of Arizona, who developed those estimations for us using existing data sets. So there is a bit of a methodological difference between 2022 and 2023, as you look at the unsheltered numbers. The sheltered numbers, standard methodology every year. So we come forward to 2023, you see that modest decrease in unsheltered homelessness because of the methodological difference. We don't know if that's a true increase, decrease, but we do see that increase in the number of people who are sheltered, which is a positive trend there. But overall, a really alarming trend about this rapidly escalating rate of unsheltered homelessness in our community, and one that we're very concerned about. So then if we, looking at the point in time count, now we can, we wanted to say, okay, so we know some numbers about people experiencing homelessness. We want to understand their experiences, what they say themselves they need, and what's working for them and what's not. And so we contracted with the University of Arizona to conduct the homeless needs assessment. I have pulled out here just a very small number of highlighted pieces of information. As Tisha mentioned, this is a really fantastic report that has been shared with you. I encourage you to dig into it. We will be hosting a presentation as well later this month. We'll be hosting a webinar that Dr. Bentley will be presenting on this data and going much more in depth in this one slide that I'm sharing with you now. But through that needs assessment, 389 adults experiencing homelessness were surveyed. 28% of those were over the age of 55. Now, that wouldn't necessarily be able to say that means that 28% of people experiencing homelessness are over the age of 55, right? This is just the population set that participated in the survey. However, that number does actually parallel what we're seeing pretty closely in the point in time count as it relates to older adults. This year was the first year that that HUD allowed the point in time count to separate older adult populations in the count by age. And so what we're seeing is an alarming number of older adults experiencing homelessness. And that's an issue that we're going to have to address as a community and think differently about. The traditional interventions, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, these types of interventions that assume that your income is going to change with it as a result of an intervention, often don't hold true for older adults whose only income opportunity may be Social Security or Social Security disability. And we know that those folks are being priced out of the market and there's a shortage of affordable housing. So I think one of the emerging crises that we'll really need to look to solve as a community is how to respond in more adaptive ways to the unique needs of older adult homelessness. Another interesting piece that came out of the survey was that of the folks surveyed, 51% had been homeless for a year or longer. And what we're seeing in the community as a whole is also this dramatic increase in chronic homelessness, that longer-term homelessness that we discussed, a 200% increase over the last few years, as well as this surge in very recent first-time homelessness of folks that may be service naive, and looks a bit like what we saw in 2008, 2009 in the housing crisis, where groups of people who previously have never had to interact with social services, but may have sort of lived on the brink, you know, and because of the pandemic in this case, or the housing crisis in that case, and being priced out of markets, now these folks have to access social services and networks that they're really unfamiliar with. And it requires a different type of intervention and a different type of engagement and outreach that I know some folks were talking about earlier today. Another finding that was interesting from the homeless needs assessment, to me at least, was that 40% of the people who participated in the survey reported that they had never completed, or I'm sorry, 40% had completed a housing assessment at some point, which means that 60% reported having never completed a housing assessment. And that housing assessment is the vulnerability index service prioritization and decision assistance tool, the VI-SPDAT, which you've maybe heard of. This is that single assessment entry into basically all homeless housing assistance that's available. There are certainly some exceptions, but the vast majority of housing assistance comes through this one assessment. And to know that over half of the folks that were surveyed in this sampling had never completed that assessment means that we know all of our data is a dramatic underrepresentation. Next, folks who participated in the surveys and focus groups reported that shelter and housing, which we would expect, food security, transportation, laundry, shower and bathroom facilities were among their most commonly unmet needs. And so that gives us an idea of some of the key areas we should be moving while really maintaining that north light that the answer to homelessness is housing. And we know that, and that is the primary solution. But also that when we're unable to house every person, having these additional supports is incredibly important. And then a positive piece of feedback that we saw in this survey was that 60% of respondents who had stayed in shelter or housing programs described their experiences as being positive. And so that knowing that folks are coming out of shelter programs, coming out of housing programs, and may or may not have resulted in long-term permanent housing, but are reporting positive interactions with service providers, with those systems, is a trend change from what we've seen in the past. And before I go on to the system modeling that really kind of looks at numbers and dollars, I want to give Dr. Bentley an opportunity if there's anything that really stood out to you through the process that you'd like to share. And of course, I've now put Keith on the spot.
Yeah, that's terrible.
I apologize.
You've done a great job. I think for me, the age at which people first experienced homelessness was very powerful. About 24% of people reported their first experience of homelessness under age 18. So that to me is, not really that surprising, but it just sort of speaks to the long-termness and the intergenerational transmission of housing insecurity and homelessness. And I have like 15 other reactions, but I will save them for the webinar. And thank you, Jason. That's a perfect job on presenting. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Keith. All right, so we'll take a look then at system modeling. And again, this is really just a very quick high-level tour to give you all an opportunity to have a discussion about opportunity areas that you may want to engage. Each of these pieces of research, there are broader reports about, and we're also happy to engage in more detailed conversations about any one of them with you. So system modeling is a process we go through. We try to do it once a year, but it's sort of on a, it doesn't always happen every year, where we try to take a look at our existing bed inventory. So how many shelter beds, how many transitional housing beds, refugee housing, permanent supportive housing, et cetera. What do we have? And then based on the number of people in our community that are experiencing homelessness on a nightly basis and the number who come through our system on a calendar year basis, and the average length of stay in those programs, the rates of exit and return to homelessness, so how many of those folks will we expect to serve in another program, and what are the kinds of pathways that people move through, so engagement in an outreach program, to a diversion program, to shelter, to rapid rehousing, onto permanent supportive, et cetera. So it's a pretty, it's a detailed process that is built entirely on estimations and assumptions. So it's data informed, it's data driven, but it's not data perfect. And so it's important to share that. So the numbers I'm sharing with you today, you are the first people to see them. They are preliminary data at this point. They are subject to change. We're still validating and testing some of the assumptions. It also is pending continuum of care board review, but I knew that this was important to the commission to begin to think about these numbers. And so so I wanted to share that with you, but ask that you just keep in mind that these numbers may change over time. So, and we have for each of these, we also have this broken down by subpopulation. So the number of shelter, transitional housing, rapid rehousing, and non-time limited housing, which means like permanent supportive housing, as well as like vouchers, things like that. We have that broken down by populations. So families with children, veterans, single, like adult only households, unaccompanied youth, survivors of domestic abuse, et cetera. So this, there's much more granular calculations here, but this is the very high level. So what we see right now is that we have 952 emergency shelter and safe haven beds in our community. That includes all of the beds reported in that housing inventory count, as well as 150 beds that are at Gospel Rescue Mission but are not counted in that report. Through that work that the community, our community partners did to develop estimations around our need, we believe that 2,529 total emergency shelter and safe haven beds are necessary in our community, which leaves us with that delta of just over 1,500 or just under 1,600 beds that we would really need to get to a point to be able to end homelessness. For transitional housing, we currently have 330 beds. We know that we would need 475, estimating a delta of about 150, 145 exactly. For rapid rehousing, this is where we see a much larger delta. So we currently have 641 beds. The estimated need based on people coming through our system on an annual and nightly basis is that we would need 3,244 beds with a delta of 2,600 beds approximately. And in that non-time-limited housing, so permanent supportive housing, et cetera, voucher programs, we have 1,953 beds dedicated to people experiencing homelessness. In total, to end homelessness, we would need approximately 4,300 beds, 4,356. And that delta is absolutely wrong. I think that that's a sum on that gap. So please, I apologize for the mathematical error there. What it should really be is about 2,400 beds is the difference. We will get that corrected in the post, in the posting on the website, but about 2,400 additional non-time limited beds that would be necessary. And so in order to do that, and this is to say, if we had the perfect system to truly end homelessness, that annual cost is estimated to be about $118.1 million to $165.4 million per year. So we know we don't have that funding available. And so then the important work of our community is to say, with the funding that we do have, how do we create the greatest impact in these areas? Like what move of the needle gives us the greatest value addition? And I think that's the spot we're at in our work now, is beginning to look at that and to figure out how do we move forward. For the time being, the continuum of care, the Tucson People Collaboration to End Homelessness, has determined that permanent supportive housing is their top priority, and continue to prioritize the creation of permanent supportive housing beds over other types of housing interventions. The commission, of course, can take similar or different approaches, but that is, yes, so that's the data. And I think where I mentioned that this is also segregated by populations, without going deep into that data here, I do want to share where we see the most critical shortfalls are in adult-only households that aren't veterans. And the reason for that is that there are veteran-specific beds, of course, in interventions for older adults, as we've previously discussed, and interventions for survivors of domestic abuse and human trafficking. Where we have the lowest deltas when we look at population groups are in homeless youth, which is something that shouldn't be too surprising to us, because we've been now managing a very large homeless youth intervention grant, $7 million a year, for the last 3 years. And we're beginning to see the positive effects of that. And then we're also seeing, we don't see as much of a gap as it relates to families with children. That concludes my presentation. Happy to field any questions. And know also we have to be mindful of time. So,
okay. So I just have a clarification. So the point in time, thank you, Jason. That was great. The point in time survey showed we have 2,209 homeless currently in Tucson. The gap with all the different items, so correcting the non-time limited housing, you're saying we need 6,700 beds. So why the discrepancy? Why do we need three times more beds is what we think is out there?
Sure. So the point in time count counts the number of people who are experiencing homelessness on a single night, right? So on January 25th, there were 2,209 people. Last year, for example, about 5,600 and I think 78, let's say about 5,600 people went through the homeless system. We also estimate that we don't even know up to 40% of people experiencing homelessness. And I think Dr. Bentley's recent needs assessment supports that and says that estimation may even be low. And so there's one, it's you're looking at the number of people over the course of a year. Two, we're also looking at the length of stay in a program. So when you think about like a non-time limited housing program, like permanent supportive housing, the average length of stay in that type of a program is 5 to 7 years. So a person goes into that bed, they may be in that bed for the next 5 years. That bed's really offline, but there's still an inflow of people experiencing homelessness who need that bed. And so the system modeling process is really designed to look at the length of stay in every program, the cost per month of stay in that program, and then the number of beds necessary to support inflow.
Thank you. Jay?
Thanks both Brandy and Jason for your presentations. I guess I have a two-part question. I think, though, I feel like you may have really answered the first part of the question. And that is really, like, what are the realistic expectations that we should have in terms of what the city is actually able to do with the resources that are available? Because to me, that seems like a big piece of the puzzle, obviously, because I would guess that a lot of people think that, you know, there are beds available for the homeless out on the street, and why don't they, you know, fill in the blank? And clearly that doesn't really seem to be possible. So to me, it seems like based on the resources available and the gap of, you know, 100 and whatever million dollars, for me, I don't have high expectations that we're going to make much of a dent in this problem. Do you think that is accurate, or do you have a different take on kind of what the expectations should be in Tucson based on the resources that are available?
Sure. So I don't want to believe that we can't make a dent. I want to believe that transformation is possible and significant transformation is possible, right? And I think we can use the dollars we have better than we do, Jay. I think that's true across the board in our community, right? And I think it is part of the reason that the system modeling process is important to me is one, to understand, but two, also to share with the community and to understand, like, when we say to end homelessness, it'll take $118 to $165 million a year, and people assume the continuum of care is the primary source of housing for people experiencing homelessness, and it receives $12 million a year, that's 10% of the need. And the reality is we are effectively reaching one out of every 10 people we meet experiencing homelessness in the community on an annual basis. I think it's actually one out of nine, but nine point something, right? And so I think we do have to be aware of what the real cost is. And I think we have to start to shift the way we partner and the way we hold each other in other systems accountable. So we know that the justice system and the behavior and behavioral health systems are pathways into homelessness. And so we need to stop thinking about homelessness response, I think, as an altruistic approach. And when I say we here, I don't want to mean you all. I know, like, you all are like the comrades in this work, right? But I think as socially, we need to stop thinking about the altruism of it and instead acknowledge that housing is a fundamental human right. This is a systemic injustice, and that these systems that lead to homelessness need to begin to fund the work, be part of the funding solution to end it. And so I think HUD is not going to end homelessness. The city is not going to end homelessness in the city. The county won't be able to either, right? We need to begin to work with different systems, and to that prevention point, sort of start blocking the on-ramps, because the on-ramps are just growing wider than the off-ramps than we'll ever build out.
Thanks for that, Jason. I appreciate that. And again, I think you kind of answered my second question as well, which is, you know, based on these limited resources, you know, we do have an obligation to end homelessness, in my opinion. So, you know, what are some of the gaps? What are some of the issues? What are some of the ways to, you know, narrow some of the on-ramps or cut off some of those on-ramps so, you know, people don't become homeless? Because I have heard that, you know, keeping people out of homeless is way more effective than trying to get people rehoused once they're on the street. So, you know, are there some things that are top of mind for you and the folks you work with to, reduce those on-ramps and identify some of those gaps so that the funds that we do have and resources we do have can be used as effectively as possible?
Yeah, and I think in here I'm happy to share a few things, Jay, and I want to kind of open that up as well to my colleagues at the city and others on the commission about thoughts that folks may have. The thing that stands out to me is, and it really requires non-federal assistance, right? But is flexible fund diversion and direct cash assistance. So so one, looking at flexible fund diversion, which is really this idea that it's all those but for costs, right? It's like, if I could just pay X, then I wouldn't lose my place, right? Because the moment I lose my place, then everything is much harder. Having flexible funding that can really just bridge in for car related issues, things like that. We were able to receive some philanthropic dollars from the Garcia Family Foundation earlier this year, piloted a $200,000 flexible fund diversion program, which was fully exhausted within 2 months and assisted just shy of 100 people, I believe. And it may be off on that number. I don't have data in front of me on it, but we're able to see really quickly how necessary it was. And then now we're beginning to look in the HMIS to see, are those, the homeless management information system, I apologize, folks, to see, did those folks end up becoming homeless or did this work? But if we're seeing that that works, then we need to be investing in more of that and trusting people to do what's best for their lives. In the same, and I'll admit I'm going a little off book here, this more adjacent thing maybe than a city thing. I don't know, it's not necessarily not a city thing, but direct cash assistance as well. So understanding that people need money to survive and providing financial assistance for people to make good decisions for themselves is important. And we spend more money in all of our staffing and mechanisms and sort of oversight protections than we would spend just allowing people to do well for themselves. Are kind of two things that stand out to me.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate that. And then finally, I think this is obviously something that we as the commission need to figure out, but, hearing all of this information and knowing that, you know, our role is really to try and advise mayor and council, what are some ideas that we could take to mayor and council that would have an impact? And what are some other ways potentially that this commission could support the work that y'all are doing with the city? Because I think, at least for me, it's sometimes difficult to take all of this information and figure out how to, you know, present it to the city and ask them to do something different and kind of operationalize this information.
Absolutely. And so I'll defer to Anne on some of the specific what to take to mayor and council. I think we are doing some of these things, but continuing to accelerate the work in creating permanent supportive housing. So if you think back to that last slide that I shared about the number of units of transitional housing, of rapid rehousing, of permanent supportive housing that we need, right? Each one in our current system, almost all of our supportive housing is a tenant-based rental assistance subsidy, which means we're telling a person, we'll pay your rent, now find a unit. Organizations are helping folks find units. It's not just good luck to you, but every person who comes off the streets and gets into housing is moving into an affordable unit. And so that's a unit that's coming off of the market that the low-income family that needs that unit in order to be able to not become homeless needs as well, right? And so we need to continue to accelerate our affordable housing creation and development. We also need to be, I believe, we need to be diversifying our housing portfolio as it relates to supportive housing as a community. I think Tucson has, like many communities over the last several decades, chosen the sort of in vogue solution du jour and gone all in on it. So there was a time, folks will remember, we were all in on single room occupancy. There were SROs everywhere. And then all of the SROs went away. And then we were all in on tenant-based rental assistance. And I think the true answer is that we need some of everything. We need to build site-based permanent supportive housing. We need to build site-based transitional housing. We also need scattered site housing. We need some congregate settings, sober living, things like that. The more we can diversify so that housing can meet folks' needs, as opposed to just trying to get funding for more voucher or subsidy when we don't have the affordable housing unit for that person to occupy, I think that piece of how we get more affordable housing in our community is really the crux.
Mark or Ann, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Jason covered all of that. Happy to share thoughts at some point, but curious Mark's thoughts.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about older adult housing, but back to Jason's point about diversification. A number of years ago, I was privileged to read just a little bit of a sociological study that was done of Skid Row in Minneapolis, I think it was, back in the 40s. And in the entry to that little book, they talked about housing options in the Bowery in New York, probably in the Gilded Age, if you will, maybe a little later than that. And it was an amazing array of odd things that involved paying, you know, maybe a dime to squat in a hallway of an SRO at night, or so. And that, you know, options which we would not even be willing to consider today. But I think we make all these policy decisions which are important, which we value around safety and security and, you know, dark skies and sidewalks and things like that, copper wiring in houses, all of which increase the cost of housing. And so, to your point, Jason, I think the idea of coming up with a broad array of options really is sort of one of the only ways we're going to get ourselves out of this. I just wanted to mention some folks have heard me start talking about this lately. In 2011, we did the first street survey using the vulnerability index in April of that year. We talked to about 400 people, a whole host of community volunteers. I've shared the data with Dr. Bentall, the report, so he can sort of bang it against. At that point, about 10% of the population were 60 years of age and older. So clearly there's been an increase, and everything I would believe leads me to believe it's going to get, you know, we're a little lagging on where that's going. But older adult homelessness is definitely an issue. Well, I was at a conference and heard people from San Diego County talk about some of the work they're doing. I'm sure you all on the city staff know more about this stuff than I do, but one of the things they were talking about in San Diego was a shallow subsidy experiment that they've been conducting. I think they lotteryized, they selected people, and I think they were making $500 shallow subsidy payments to people, older adults, in order to keep them, again, the issue of keeping them housed. And then, of course, I've heard a lot of stories, some of the rest of us may have, about the guaranteed annual income experiments that are going on in a whole host. From what I hear, National Public Radio, a pretty significant increase in experiments cities are doing. I think Salinas, California, or I don't know, somewhere over in California, maybe Sonoma has done one of those, but there's a whole bunch of them going on. So there really are a lot of different things people are looking at. So that's probably enough for me right now.
Thanks, Mark. So I want to take a crack at answering Jay's question about what can be done, because I think we've already gone to the city with some really good options. And I think it's important as a commission that we continue to bird dog those. I agree with what Jason said. There's not like a silver bullet that's going to take care of all of this. It's going to have to be a multi-pronged approach. It's very complicated, but we've made, I think, three key recommendations to the city that will help. The city can't do it by itself. The city's got to work with the county, it's got to work with the state, and we've got to work with the feds to really make a significant impact. But I believe that the three things that the city can do to have the biggest impact is to reestablish the Housing Trust Fund, to relook at the zoning code on what can be done to make more sites available for building housing, and to evaluate putting a bond measure on the ballot. I think putting a bond measure on the ballot could generate a significant amount of money to go towards affordable housing. And I think it's important that we continue to push those agenda items. That's my personal feeling. Okay, any other comments or questions for?
Joe had a question, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe. And then Keith.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to add real quick, since Mark was talking about basic income, there's a book a few years ago, Rutger Bregman had a big section of it in Utopia for Realists. And there are some really good UBI advocates out there that talk about those kind of programs. I think it's tough for me to speak on the return on investment on various solutions we're talking about here. But I know something that has proved in lots of areas to show a good ROI are right to counsel programs that can help people stay in their units and keep people from being evicted, keep people from entering homelessness. So if we're talking about limiting those on-ramps, right to counsel, the money spent, I know we a few years ago went to the county and talked about that. And that's when we got the Emergency Eviction Legal Service Program. Maybe it's time to look at codifying that into a right to counsel and broadening that, the city and county coming together to help with that program. Because with as much money as we're talking about spending to end homelessness or to prevent people from homelessness, I think the return on investment has shown in many places, everywhere that's been tried, that's a good program for that. Thanks.
Thank you, Joe. Keith?
Yeah, I just want to jump in very quickly and second everything Jason said and highlight it and underline it. But I wanted to double underline his last comment about the affordable housing stock and the fact that we use vouchers as our main way to rehouse people. And so in my opinion, the affordable housing crisis is basically breaking our system. And we do manage to house some people, but most people, in my opinion, again, are not able to take that voucher and find a unit. And when you are dealing with people with enormous prevalence of trauma and mental health issues and physical disability, on and on and on, it's, in my opinion, very cruel to ask folks to figure this out on their own in many cases. And you have caseworkers that are doing the best they can and not able to link people. And it just creates a very negative, toxic experience, I think, for most folks involved. And it's not the fault of people who are working so hard to try to house these people, and in many cases, people experiencing homelessness who are doing every single thing they can to find a landlord that will take their voucher. And when that breaks and that doesn't work, and it took a really long time to get that voucher, I think that's a really huge contributing factor to why people do not try anymore and do not engage with services that are available, even some of the more simple harm reduction services that would really help them on a day-to-day basis because of that feeling of broken trust and lack of an effective outcome, while simultaneously seeing some other folks successfully being housed. So when a small fraction of people are being successfully housed, it creates resentment, it creates hostility amongst populations who are experiencing homelessness. So I just want to underline that the affordable housing stock problem is, impacts a lot of different things, but I think it's really particularly problematic for the off-ramp, for our capacity to rehouse folks experiencing homelessness.
Heath, we obviously had a lot of presentations on the voucher program. And I think about a year and a half or 2 years ago, they said that there was roughly 800 vouchers that were not being used because they couldn't find apartments that would accept them. Has that number shrank or grown?
I'm going to look at somebody else on that. I don't have that number.
Do you happen to know that? They did, we had the source of income protection.
Yeah. I don't, Jim, but we can get that number and report back next month.
I think it'd be interesting to hear that. Okay, just in the interest of time, I think we need to move on. Is there any final comments? Okay, let me get the agenda here. Okay, next item is number 5, the Prosperity Initiative. So this is presented by HCD and Pima County. I'm not sure who at HCD is doing that.
I think I can mostly just hand it over to Bonnie, given time and everything. So let's hand it over to Bonnie.
Thanks, Allison. Good evening, everyone. It's really a privilege to be with you again. Keith and I are going to make a very brief presentation. We know we have 10 minutes. And so I'm going to just start with the presentation here. And really, everybody can see that on the screen, all right? Thanks, Jim. My part is just to give you a little brief reminder of the Prosperity Initiative. We were with you a few months ago talking about the first housing policy we had on mobility. And tonight we really want to talk about the housing stability, which certainly fits well into the conversation. And again, I just want to echo others, Brandy and Jason, what a great presentation and wonderful discussion. So just a reminder that the Prosperity Initiative is has the mandate of developing a set of policies that are research and evidence-based and that can guide long-term efforts to create community wealth by addressing generational poverty and improving opportunity. So we know we need to address immediate needs, but we really, this is really about getting upstream and thinking about a generational impact. The idea is that we have these bundled policies for adoption or adaptation by local governments. And as Supervisor Grijalva says here, it's again, it's really thinking about change for the next generation. And then we have Keith and Brian Mayer, who are our researchers working with us. And we're very grateful. Keith has just done fabulous work. And he'll be talking about some of the policies he's working on. This initiative has two phases. We're in the policy development phase. Initially, we said 5 to 10, and we're looking at 13 policies now, along with three what we're calling cross-policy strategies. Lots of conversations in the community and with national policy experts. The next phase is around really looking then at implementation strategies, scanning and analyzing our current priorities and spending to see where we can better align, where we're duplicating, where there's missed opportunities, and more investigation of smart strategic implementation strategies, and a lot more conversation out in the community as well. So we really have these four policy areas: education, critical family resources, asset building and infrastructure priorities, and then again, these cross-policy strategies. So with that, I want to turn it over to Keith and let Keith start walking us through the policies he's been working in.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. Hi, everybody. I'm Keith Bentley. I want to tell you that the amount of restraint it took me to be quiet during this entire meeting, where every single thing that was mentioned, is near and dear to my heart. So I strongly encourage you to invite me back to talk more, but we can talk about that later. So the two policies I want to talk about today are housing mobility and housing stability. Let's just jump right into them. We can go to the next one. So the housing mobility strategy, which we've already shared with y'all, if you remember, the main point of this was to reduce the geographic concentration of poverty by kind of adopting practices and policies that will both allow folks using vouchers to relocate to high opportunity areas and also incentivize the creation of affordable housing in higher opportunity areas. So increasing the number of mixed income neighborhoods in higher opportunity areas, and allowing more flexibility. And again, the big idea there is that the concentration of poverty itself has a huge number of additional harms and negative effects, in addition to just the kind of individual household level experience of poverty. So breaking up that concentration is argued and demonstrated to have a lot of benefits in and of itself, and our affordable housing strategies can be aligned with that goal. So we think this outcome is aligned with three mandates: the City of Tucson's HAST, the Pima County Regional Affordable Housing Commission's mandate, and also is consistent with HUD's Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing mandate, which I won't read you all, and I hope you're all very familiar with, but basically encourages the use of policies and practices to overcome patterns like concentrations of poverty that are linked to segregation and discrimination historically. So the housing stability brief, which we're going to spend the most time on today in my super fast, quick talking presentation, the main prongs here are preventing evictions and foreclosures, mitigating these negative consequences when there are forced moves, increasing home ownership, especially in higher poverty areas, as a strategy to increase individual household stability, but also the stability of the housing stock within communities, And then increasing the stock of affordable housing generally. And I just want to say, I'm not going to spend time on the fourth piece today, but the most cost-effective way to reduce poverty is to reduce the main expenditure for any low-income household, which is almost always housing. Sometimes transportation competes for low-income folks in rural areas, but generally housing is your major cost. And so increasing the stock of affordable housing both reduces expenses for low-income households, and it also allows folks to more successfully resolve when they experience an eviction or a forced move, right? If there's somewhere else they can go that they can afford, then it again mitigates so many of those negative consequences that come with people being displaced. Okay, so the previous slide had a bunch of benefits potentially of reducing housing instability. We'll jump past that. So these are just some programs that we've identified. Okay, so let's do it. So increasing housing stability can reduce homelessness and all of the negative impacts and costs associated with homelessness. It improves the incomes of households. It improves their health, physical and mental, educational attainment for children. Preventing things like foreclosures prevents the loss of like critical intergenerational wealth and also the loss of wealth within communities. And then it reduces other negative impacts to like employees and to children in schools. So the three that are here are the ones that I would say are in one sense the most vanilla and standard. But part of the reason for presenting these are the programs through which we have very robust evidence to suggest that they are very powerful and effective in reducing harm. So rental assistance programs have been found to reduce food insecurity amongst low-income households. Households are more likely to afford medical care when they're receiving rental assistance, and the educational outcomes for children are often better. And this is just a small fraction of the benefits. These are just some examples. Households receiving housing vouchers were less likely to experience homelessness over time and less likely to move in general on a larger window of time. And then last, legal representation programs have been found unambiguously to dramatically reduce the likelihood of having an eviction judgment. And they also have been found to dramatically reduce long-term negative consequences. So if you avert getting an eviction on your record, this can be profoundly impactful in terms of your ability to find housing again. So one of the things I argue in this brief is that because the harms of evictions and forced moves, which I'll list in a moment, are so broad, that this is a really high impact intervention. So preventing someone from having a very disruptive forced move can reduce a wide array of harms to both adults and to children. And because evictions and forced moves are so highly concentrated in low-income communities, the impact of these protections would also be highly concentrated within those communities. And these are disproportionately communities that have historically experienced underinvestment and discrimination. In addition, a positive side of this is that when you have folks who have built assets and achieved home ownership, for example, preventing the loss of that can be very, very dramatic, both again at the individual household level and also for those impacted communities. Okay, so I said before that the harms are broad. So foreclosures and evictions, and this research is particularly focusing on the impacts of evictions. Reducing evictions reduces churn in the housing market. It reduces the number of caseloads that homeless service providers are having to support. The likelihood of homelessness at an individual level goes down. And then there's enormous amounts of health research on the impacts of evictions. And this is just like, this goes on and on for pages. But basically, almost any physical or mental health problem that you can imagine is exacerbated by experiencing a forced move or an eviction. Reducing evictions reduces overall system costs. So if you think about healthcare costs to mitigate those consequences, or you think about our homeless system, homeless management system response, those are costs that are reduced. People don't lose material possessions, and they don't lose the equity they've built if there were a homeowner. And then last, the positive benefits are the reductions of all those harms. It increases the efficacy of other safety net programs. It increases the health, well-being, and productivity of employees and community members. And for children, the impacts of these disruptions can be very damaging and lifelong in some cases, especially cognitive development can be impacted by these experiences. Also, child abuse goes up when people are under stress. So the absence of those harms can have profound positive benefits for the life course for children. Homeownership is another policy or sort of strategy we're recommending here to increase stability. The research is unambiguous here as well that homeownership is associated with many, many positive outcomes. More housing stability over time, more wealth building, which allows to provide more opportunities for children. Wealth also allows you to mitigate unexpected strains and costs more effectively and can take something like a job loss or illness in the family and make all the difference between that turning into an experience of homelessness or losing your home and getting through that family crisis. And children who grow up in homes where their parents own the home, they're more likely to go to college, they're less likely to apply for public assistance, and they're 1.5 more times more likely to own their own home. So this is something that can really provide a much stabler environment for children. And again, at a community level, also increase the stability of the communities in general. We have a many implementation strategies in our brief, but top three here, which are connected to either recently existing or existing programs that we have. So continuing the EELS program, the Pima County's Emergency Eviction Legal Services Program. And I would say, I'll just editorialize for a moment here and dramatically expanding this program. I think this is, again, a very high impact intervention that can reduce a lot of harm. Developing an emergency rental assistance program would also provide critical needed support to households that are experiencing like a financial crunch. This is something that we just saw in excruciating detail, enormous harm reduced by the provision of rental assistance that was federally funded during the pandemic. Most of that money, there's a little left and still going for a little while, but most of that money will run out at some point soon. And I think that we really do have an opportunity to continue to build both on that infrastructure which exists and to continue those positive benefits of that rental assistance. And then the last one here is finding ways to find non-judicial resolution of eviction disputes. So if you can mediate an interaction that does not result in eviction on someone's record, this will, again, just dramatically increase their likelihood of being able to find housing on their own. And I can't tell you the number of people who I spoke to experiencing homelessness right now in Tucson who said having an eviction was the main barrier for them, and having very little money and then having to pay application fees over and over for rentals that they keep getting evicted from, again, is extremely demoralizing and dispiriting for folks. So this is a place where it's a little technical and in the weeds, but it has enormous consequences for people, and it never goes away. It follows you forever, and it's a real problem. Okay, and then I'll very quickly just touch on a neighborhood reinvestment, not a policy, but we are trying to propose kind of a framework for how to think about neighborhood reinvestment. So one thing is just to say very generally that it is very clear that the quality of neighborhoods have dramatic impacts for children and their long-term life outcomes. Not surprising, but I just want to say that we have this threshold here that everything needs to be clearly evidence-based and have empirical backing. And so we are using this research to say that child well-being and upward mobility would be enhanced by investing in different aspects of neighborhoods. What's complicated about this for us is that we are concerned about displacement impacts, and we're also concerned about making decisions for neighborhoods in terms of what they should focus on. So the research suggests that a wide range of characteristics of neighborhoods impact children and impact their long-term outcomes. So what we've tried to do here is identify kind of this range, if we can go to the next slide, Bonnie, of these neighborhood characteristics that have been linked to long-term, lifelong outcomes for children. So these are examples here, different education characteristics, health and environment characteristics, and then social and economic characteristics of neighborhoods. So what we are suggesting is that instead of a specific prong or policy, what the neighborhood reinvestment approach should be is something like a conversation with local communities to help them identify what of these important neighborhood characteristics are most important to them to focus on in terms of reinvestment. And so with the assumption being that we're never going to have enough resources to do all of these great things. But if the neighborhood wants to select ones that are kind of most near and dear or feel most urgent to them, then that will allow some community direction to how that investment unfolds. And then we have a couple examples of some of the implementation characteristics. So I am very focused on preventing displacement as being a major piece of what's available. Some of this could live in this housing stability policy, which is sort of for everyone. But I do think that we can also target these protections to these neighborhoods that are experiencing development. And so I just wanted to say really clearly, when people are trying to figure out how do you reinvest without displacing folks, just a couple best practices are constantly cited. One is that you really need to engage with community members and get them involved and invested in the process, and that generally dramatically increases the acceptance and the positive impacts of these types of investments. And secondarily, that you need to build protective policies in, and those protective policies need to precede that investment that is driving up housing costs potentially or driving up rents and putting pressure on folks that might displace them. So big picture, preserving affordable housing within these communities, affording experiencing investment, expanding the affordable housing stock as these investments are made, with the understanding that some of the naturally existing affordable housing may be priced out as a result of that investment. We also want to broaden the lens here to think really broadly in terms of what we're thinking about when we talk about investments. So not just these types of policies that you think of roads and streetlights and things like this, but also investments in the kind of the social and the social character, but also the health of community members. So number three there is about access to resources. So we're arguing for centers located in neighborhoods where people can get access to services, navigators to link people. I think a major finding is that navigators dramatically increase the efficacy of benefit programs, which people often don't engage with at all, let alone engage with the wide range of programs for which they are often eligible. We also think there's a huge opportunity coming with lots of federal money to support weatherization and other climate resiliency investments. And again, I'll just editorialize very quickly. I think that it makes a lot of sense for these historically underinvested in neighborhoods to kind of be first in line for some of this climate mitigation and some of these remediation investments that these communities need. And then the last piece there is about centralizing community voice, right? So the idea here is that you find these neighborhoods that need these investments through these tools like the Climate Opportunity Index or the Climate and Economic Justice Screening Tool, which comes from the Biden administration. And then again, involve the communities in kind of deciding what they want to focus on and to prioritize. I think me and Bonnie are happy to take any questions. And again, I apologize about the fastness and still running over. So worst of all worlds. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Keith. And thank you, Bonnie. Who has anybody have a question? Jay?
I don't have a question so much as, you know, I think we as a commission have been trying to figure out what housing equity means, what it looks like, and how we can kind of move that ball forward, whatever that may be. And I think what I believe is impactful about what Keith just shared with us is essentially he just outlined what housing equity looks like. I mean, I'm sure we could throw a couple of other things in there, but, you know, if we wanted to just start running with a framework and trying to put some meat on the bones, I think that, you know, we've got a really great outline here that Keith has just described. And I think it's really interesting to look at what I think are the two extremes, right? It's like you have these upstream interventions that, you know, help the most marginalized neighborhoods. And then what we saw, the outcome of not doing that is homelessness. And that is essentially, I think, the continuum that we see. I'm really happy, Keith, that you pointed out the role that segregation has played in this. And I think that's the importance for me of having the housing desegregation subcommittee as part of this committee. And then I will, two more things. One thing I don't see us doing, and I know we have limited capacity as a commission, but as we all know, we just have a very limited community engagement that's informing the work that we do. And I think that's a real missing piece we need to pay attention to. And finally, if y'all haven't read Matthew Desmond's latest book, Poverty by America, It's a great read, particularly for the work we're doing. It helps outline the systems in place that essentially are helping to make and keep people poor versus the benefits in place once you get a little bit of money and the help that wealthier Americans receive. So anyway, Keith, thanks so much for the presentation. Thank you, Bonnie. The work you guys are doing with equity really should be guiding, in my opinion, all of the policies that the city and the county are undertaking from here on out. So I'll leave it at that. Mark?
So I have a question about deconcentration. And I'm a little nervous about talking about it because I think this could, I could go off in a poorly phrased conversation and well, anyway, I'll just shut up and ask. So I'm curious about effects of some of the deconcentration effects on communities of interest and historic places, neighborhoods, for instance. You see some of, I'm not suggesting deconcentration and and urban renewal are close or anything else, but I recall when the city did what some people were think of as one of the best Hope 6 programs in the country, projects that was the Connie Chambers Posada Sentinel revitalization a number of years ago, and the agency that I was running at the time had services, was had a child care center in that neighborhood. And I remember there was a lot of concern from folks, and it maybe even been a oral history done by teens that talked about that concern of breaking up that historic, longtime multifamily public housing project and the folks that live there. Now, I assume because of a lot, there have been a fair amount of that Hope 6, those Hope 6 projects done around the country, that there's been research on the impact of that approach. And so I'm curious to hear about that. And that may be a longer conversation or for a different forum.
I can just say very quickly, and Bonnie, if do you want to jump in? Specifically on the Hope 6, there has been a lot of research on the impacts of those programs. And what I would say is that the outcomes vary enormously, and from ranging from like what you would hope to the absolute worst possible outcome, where the lowest income people are the most displaced, and you know the only people who benefited were the new residents and the landlords and developers, right? So what I have taken away from that research is that you know the implementation details matter enormously in terms of how these things are implemented. And again, that when protections are structured early and built into the process, and the communities involved are built into the process, you have a much, much higher probability of avoiding these displacement outcomes. However, they still happen, right? And so when you have things like right to return or targeted relocation support for people who are displaced, those are some of the ways to deal with those unavoidable consequences. On the relocation piece, I'll just say very quickly, and I feel like again, we started with the housing mobility programs because there's such a strong evidence base for them. But I feel like we constantly get on this little distracting side conversation, which is what about those people who want to stay in their neighborhood and they don't want to leave? So I'll just say quickly, the volume of vouchers that we have is very small relative to housing insecurity. And so in the first place, there's never going to be a situation where we're draining neighborhoods because so many people are relocating to high opportunity areas. Like that would almost be a better world in some ways. So I don't think we're going to have that problem. And secondarily, I would say that this strategy is specifically trying to do both: allow people to stay by increasing housing stability, increasing investments in historically underinvested in neighborhoods while protecting against displacement. So that's the like, shouldn't we just be putting money into these low-income communities piece? And then I think there are people who have been bouncing around for years, who have been homeless for years, who are new to the community and don't have particular attachments and would love to live in a nice neighborhood on their voucher, but there are no affordable housing units in those high opportunity areas, right? So to me, these are totally complementary. Nobody is forced. If you get a voucher, you can live where, you know, you can live wherever you can find a place to live. And so there, again, there's not going to be this problem, I would say, of people being forced to relocate, which I think is kind of people's first concern when they hear this. And I'll just say on top of all of that, that the deconcentrating piece, I think, is really important. It is really powerful. It kind of makes all of our public investments like more efficient and effective because they're hitting a broader swath of our population instead of being concentrated in some areas. And allowing some low-income people to relocate, I think, is totally fair in a world where we haven't sort of addressed those deep pockets of poverty yet. So I'll stop there, but those are kind of my main reactions.
And can I just add to that, Mark? And I'm, you know, not an expert in this, but two things. I almost feel like we need a finer tuned lens for understanding the dynamics in these neighborhoods, because certainly there are people who've been there generationally and have great investment in those neighborhoods. But I also know we have a lot of mobility and churn. And I know that because I worked in the YLES program when we launched that. And, you know, every day people are getting evicted and having to move unwillingly, right? And I also think if we looked at mobility numbers for the elementary schools that are in those neighborhoods, that would be a good measure of how much, you know, mobility there is in those neighborhoods. And so I like both of these policies as Keith framed it, because, you know, we want to strengthen and the ability of people to stay in the neighborhoods when they want to, or to be able to move to other places. So I feel like we're kind of getting a both and strategy in this, but I think we do have a lot of families who are forced to move and frequently, and that's what we really want to help to address.
Okay. Just in the interest of time, we're going to, Shay, you can go, and then we're going to move to the next agenda item.
Yeah, I was just wondering too, if it works. I mean, when you think about where to start, right? Like, wouldn't you want to start also in the areas that have the highest need? I mean, I don't know. That's where it's like, yeah, it's an interesting framework that could be, I feel like, argued a few different ways.
Okay. But can I just ask Shay a question? Shay, do you feel like the policies aren't doing that? Because I feel like both the housing stability and the neighborhood reinvestment very much speak to how do we bring in the appropriate resources for areas of higher poverty.
Yeah, definitely. But you could actually go geolocationally and start, right? Figure. I mean, you guys were speaking more broadly, but I think you can really, like you're saying, start to dial in a geographic way into those neighborhoods where they are and really locate them.
Okay, so we have about 7 minutes left in this agenda. I guess I'd like to just ask the commissioners if anyone would object to postponing agenda items 7 and 8 to our next meeting. I want to give Anne a chance to brag quickly on agenda item 6. And I have one question I'd like to ask the group on agenda item 9. And then we'll try to get through 10 and 11 quickly. Does that work for everybody? Or does anyone object to that?
My one thought there, Jim, I can be real quick bragging. And the retreat, I know there are at least some that are sort of just interested in like putting those wheels in motion a little more. So that's just one consideration.
Okay. I'm happy to give a quick update on that. So, okay, so let's postpone agenda item number 8. You go ahead and do enough.
And the intention wasn't a bragging moment, but I think many of you know we did we got word last week, week before, it's been a whirlwind, that we are receiving the $50 million Choice Neighborhoods grant. I think just piggybacking off of the conversation you just had, I'm looking forward to a longer discussion about what's in it and really the intentions around between the $50 million and we're leveraging over $300 million. It's a lot of investment in a really low income area. And so just mindful of the conversation you just had and sort of what that looks like. So we will be working with HUD on, we submitted our application and our proposal and we can share those details. But now HUD will come back and kind of refine what we did and we'll really actually be able to start moving forward. We have a lot of partners, some on this call. We're always looking for more partners with this grant since it takes a lot of resources and time and energy to really think intentionally about how to support a very low-income community and do that in a way that can benefit the residents there now. So more soon, but did want to just make sure the commission is aware that we got the grant and we'll share more details. Some of you have asked for details, and so we'll share that at a future meeting.
Congratulations, Anne, and everybody else at HCD. I know that it was a tremendous amount of work to put together that application. A couple times I called Anne over 2 or 3 weeks and she was completely stressed out. And I know Jason and Allison and Ernesto and others, Sarah, spent a lot of time working on that proposal. So congratulations. And I'm very happy for you guys.
Thank you. And I agree. All those people were amazing.
Okay. Any other comments before we move on? All right. So quickly on agenda item number 7, we received feedback from the city of Tucson that we really did need to use a city approved facilitator. And so we had a meeting this last week with Tahani Robinson and Colleen Whitaker. They are going to put together a proposal for the commission. I was hoping to meet with them yesterday, but they had a medical issue that came up. So they weren't able to provide us a detailed proposal, but I do expect that for our next meeting. And the components of it are going to be similar to what we saw before, where they're going to meet with each of the subcommittee chairs and then have several meetings with the commission as a whole. And then we'd like to do a half-day retreat. And so we'll get the details of that scheduled out here for the next meeting. But is there, so I guess one question is, Ray has been involved and Jay has been involved. I'm assuming that the two of you want to continue to be involved in the facilitator discussions. Is there anybody else that wants to be involved in that? Okay. Well, we'll have more to report then on the next meeting. So jumping down to agenda item number 9, open commission positions, commissioner positions. We have 2 open positions right now. And they're both kind of earmarked for specialty people. So one of them is Michael Edmonds' spot, which is, and Michael's with us today. But somebody who is basically using some of the affordable housing voucher programs that we have in the city and can provide that perspective. I think that's an important position to maintain.
Jim, just one update there. The most recent mayor and council meeting, they did approve having an ex officio for that role. So and given it's a non-voting and it's director discretion, I did submit Mike's name to be that member. so just an update there that is in motion.
Okay, that's great. So we need to replace that position. The other position is the youth position. And the question that I have for the commission members is, do we want to maintain a youth position? Did we find it of value? Do we want to just open it up to potentially somebody with more experience? My personal feeling is that this is a very complex topic. It's a very complex set of issues. And Kimbriana, I met with her several times. She's a good person. I think she was doing the best she could, but I think it's a very uncomfortable position as a youth member. And this commission might be better served with another experienced person in the affordable housing industry. So I guess I was hoping somebody would make a motion that that the youth member be opened up to somebody that's, you know, not a youth member. So, Lori? Oh, you're on mute.
Well, I agree with you, Jim, that it is complicated. I think we have to do a better job as a commission of including a young person. There isn't a single person on this commission that represents that age group, and they are very much affected by the policies and decisions that are made. And so I think it's our job as a commission to make it a more friendly place for a young person and not just to count them out and include another older adult.
Okay. Mindy?
I am in agreement with what Lori had said and would like to make a motion that the youth position be abandoned to be filled by an individual with more experience. However, we continue to look for people to join, but not officially as a commission person. Unless somebody knows how to find somebody youth at that age.
So, Mindy,
I can't talk today. I'm so sorry. I'm so tired.
Mindy, let's let Ray and Wendy talk quickly, and then we'll come back to that motion and
okay.
clarify it. Is that okay?
Totally. Everything's easy with me. You know that.
Thanks.
I agree with Lori that I think it is important to have a youth position. And I think if we're speaking in a way that's alienating enough that a younger person couldn't understand, like one, I think there's some assumptions there that just because someone's young doesn't mean that they can understand some of the complexity of these issues. And two, like, I think that this commission is supposed to represent residents of Tucson, which include a lot of young people. We heard earlier today in Keith's presentation that it's like 24% are entering houselessness before the age of 18. I think the youth position is up to 24 years old. Is that right? I think they're incredibly intelligent people who are in that age bracket, who have a lived experience that is not being represented on the commission right now. And I do believe that there are young people who could fill that role and would like to focus on filling that rather than abandoning the position.
What do you guys think about, so Victoria has an interesting idea in the chat. What do you guys think about maybe getting somebody from youth on their own or somebody who works with that age group as a representative versus somebody who's in that age group?
Well, that person is me. I work at Youth on Their Own, but I am not a young person. You know, I think I have a lot of experience with that population, but I don't think that I'm a good stand-in for someone who is young and has experienced homelessness, as I am neither of those things.
My apologies, Lori.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, so given some of the things that we've heard, especially what Keith described and what Ray just reiterated, I think it is important for us to have a youth representative on the commission, and that it's been hard to find somebody doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking. What I could suggest as part of that is, you know, since we do have some connections with youth on their own, maybe that's a place to identify a younger person rather than looking at a staff person who works with those folks. And in order to make us a more welcoming and easy to work with group, maybe we could set up somebody to mentor that youth member to make it easier for them to understand some of the issues or some of the language that might not be as clear to them as it is to us. But I think their lived experience, particularly with those statistics about how many people are entering homelessness at such a young age, I don't think we can avoid this.
Okay. I'm not stuck on this idea. It was something I wanted to throw out and get the feedback. So I feel like we've got pretty good consensus on keeping a youth member, and I'm perfectly fine with that. I want to make sure we get the right person. So let's go ahead, Tisha, and then Mark.
Yeah, thank you. I think 18 to 24, I mean, what we're seeing is we're seeing older folks experiencing homelessness and younger. The 18 to 24 group is very, very vital. I'm a firm believer in inclusivity and a participatory model, and I think their inclusion on the commission would be very important. However, I'm also saying that you have to put the right things in place in order to make it a successful inclusion, right? True inclusion. So, you know, I hope there's consideration to any barriers that might limit their ability to participate fully. And those, you know, I'm happy to be a part of a group that thinks through those retention pieces in order to ensure true inclusivity.
Mark?
I think they're having been a youth person on boards many, many, many years ago. I mean, there's pretty good learning about that. One of the challenges, of course, is identifying a person to represent a larger group of people, and not then having, and therefore not having those folks have an experience of allyship among the group. And so, as Tisha and others have said, trying to figure out how we build systems in that support and welcome everybody is really important. I absolutely think we need younger voices at the table, just like I think we need sometimes older voices at the table too.
Okay, so let's move on. Let's keep our youth member. I am fine with it. The reason I was thinking these things is because of the interactions I had with Ken Brianna offline and, you know, some of the feedback that she gave me. So I do think it's important as a group that we help with mentoring the youth member and helping them bring them up to speed and feeling comfortable to communicate that perspective. So I think Anne actually has somebody in mind that she might be able to bring.
And I'll just say, and anybody is welcome to do this. Somebody was referred to me and I'm trying to meet them. And so hoping that by next meeting, we can get that process rolling of getting somebody appointed.
Okay. Everybody good moving on? Armindy, you want to say one last thing?
Yes, please. Victoria wrote in the chat that a few ideas, I can't find it. Youth on their own. She put something else in there, leadership, either youth leadership programs in the city, but also Ray had in the chat volunteered to fill in the youth or the young adult position? No? Oh.
No, I just said I would help support with finding and getting someone connected to it. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely not in that age category.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. It's my age. Okay, that's it. Sorry. That's it.
All right. Thank you guys for that feedback. I do appreciate it. Okay, so item number 10 is the subcommittee updates, and I'm going to just ask me try to get through these quickly. First is Housing First with Tisha.
Yeah, real short, we did meet. Brandy gave us an update on the Housing First program. And then we also begun a conversation about what sorts of goals, mission, or, you know, purpose for the particular subcommittee. This particular subcommittee is the only one that does not have a stated mission, purpose, or goal. So we've tried to further that conversation a bit, and we landed on inviting Anne or one of her team members to join us in the next subcommittee meeting. I think, however, though, Anne, and I'll go back with the members, we may have had those questions that were outstanding with the members answered through the presentations today, which were very comprehensive and substantive. So I'll go back and confirm that. But that's the update.
Okay, thank you. Next is the housing consideration, Jay.
We did not meet, so there's no update.
Okay. I'll give the update on affordable housing because Shay was absent. And then we can, if there's any questions, we can do it for all three subcommittees. So we spent the majority of our time kind of talking about an affordable housing goal for the city of Tucson. So there are 10,826 affordable housing units within the city of Tucson. There's roughly 1,192 under development right now. So by 2026, we're anticipating 12,018 units within the city of Tucson, assuming that none drop out of the programs. So for the 2023 awards, we're anticipating an additional 487 units to be developed here over the next couple of years. So we're going to kick it around a little bit more the next meeting, but I anticipate the next CEHD meeting that the Affordable Housing Subcommittee is going to provide a recommendation to the commission on a 2020 goal of affordable housing units. What was suggested at the last subcommittee was an additional 400 units per year. If we did that by 2030, that would put us at 13,618. To put that in context, Tucson currently has a deficit of 29,700 affordable housing units at the 50% AMI. So we're talking about adding 1,200 units when we have a deficit of 29,000. So it's a very small percentage of the need. Okay, so any questions on any of the subcommittees? Keith?
Jim, I was just curious. I missed where those numbers came from in terms of those projections.
Different places. So the current stock came primarily from Jason and HCD. And then the projects under development, I got a lot of that information from the state websites and just what I know is going on and talking to developers that are working on affordable housing projects in Tucson. There's only six or seven developers that are doing deals right now. So
thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, agenda item number 11, HCD updates. And anything else you want to talk about?
Nah, I'll skip for next month.
Okay. All right, agenda item number 12, next steps. The next commission meetings are September 7th and October 5th. The Affordable Housing Subcommittee is meeting August 16th. Housing desegregation is August 24th. And the Housing First is August 29th. So we've got a couple of agenda items that we've discussed so far today. Do any of the commission members have an agenda item that they want to see in our next meeting? Mindy?
If not an agenda item, some information on how many city lots or city properties are currently abandoned or are just empty lots that buildings can be put upon them. I really cannot talk today. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
So vacant lot inventory?
A lot inventory and building unused or abandoned.
Okay, I'll drop Corin an email and see if she has that information.
Thank you.
Okay, two quick things just to bring up quickly before we adjourn. The city of Tucson is going through an effort to develop Plan Tucson. And I would encourage the commission members to participate in that. I think Ernesto is going to be sending out an email. The signups were due last week, but I think if you send them an email, they could probably still get us in. And I'd like the commission members, if you participate, to be there basically as an advocate for affordable housing. The other thing that's going to be happening this next month is the State Affordable Housing Conference is going to be taking place from the 23rd to the 25th here in Tucson at the JW Marriott. I don't know if it's sold out or not, but that might be something worth participating in if you're interested. I think everybody who's involved, oh, it is sold out. Okay, so I actually have one extra ticket. If somebody wants to go, I was a sponsor and they gave me a couple tickets with that. So if there's somebody who is interested in participating, please reach out to me and I can get it to you. And with that, we are adjourned at 6:16. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks.
Hey, Victoria, did you have something from me specifically?